Every new escalation is greater than the one before, and here we now arrive at a moment of genocide and Holocaust because the world has allowed Israel to act with such barbarity, with impunity.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you also, you mentioned what the world's reaction. More people have died in Gaza in less than 5 months than have civilians that have died in Ukraine in over 2 years in the war in Ukraine. And Ukraine is 40 times the population of Gaza. I'm wondering your sense of the failure of the, especially of the Western nations of Europe and the United States to act.
The Western world has lost any semblance of moral authority, if they ever had any. Or, you know, I think that maybe there was an illusion of moral authority previously, but I think, you know, what we have always known is that we are dealing with genocidal colonizers. But I think that is more apparent to the rest of the world at this hour. And I think what's also happening is that Americans are coming to understand increasingly, though not nearly enough, that they're being
lied
to.
And we're going to take up that issue in part two of our discussion, which we'll post at democracynow.org. Susan Abahawa, Palestinian novelist. Thanks so much.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented programmers. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321 right now. We thank you, and you're welcome.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Commissioner Carmen Rubio suspends city enforcement of the restaurant odor code over complaints of racial bias.
Thar she blows, a gray whale is spotted off the coast of Nantucket for the first time in more than 200 years.
And in international news, Israel scuttles talks with Hamas over their demand for a permanent ceasefire.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 6, 2024. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Portland City Commissioner Carmen Rubio suspends inspections of restaurant odor complaints. This comes after Pho Gabo closed its Northeast Portland location due to odor complaints. They stem from one person who repeatedly called the Bureau of Development Services, which houses the city's restaurant inspectors. This person complained that the neighborhood, quote, smelled like a wok dish, and that led to a dozen visits from city inspectors, fines, and a call for a $40,000 air filtration system. Trade and community groups have spoken out since the restaurant closed, calling the city odor code, quote, unfair and unbelievable. There isn't an objective metric for determining if a smell breaks the odor code. It comes down to the inspector's judgment. The Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association demanded the city, quote, cease targeting small restaurants and their owners, many of whom are people from various racial and ethnic backgrounds, end quote. Now, Commissioner Rubio is suspending enforcement of the restaurant odor code. Late last month, she met with Pho Gabo owner Eddie Dong and started an evaluation of the city codes in order to make recommendations. Any recommendations would then go to the Planning Commission, then the City Council, for final approval.
A proposal allocating $30 million to summer school is moving to the Oregon House for a vote. Oregon failed to allocate any money last summer for summer semester or community-based summer learning programs. That lack of funding led to some programs shutting down, as well as school districts and larger groups like the YMCA and Boys and Girls Club cutting field trips, among other budget cuts. The eight member of the Joint Ways and Means Education Subcommittee unanimously voted in favor. A survey from the nonprofit Oregon After School and Summer for Kids Network found that around half of community groups had to scale back summer programming due to funding shortages. This is despite increasing demand statewide. Nonetheless, Democratic leaders criticized the $50 million proposed by McClain. They seek to preserve the state's general fund for Governor Kotek's housing and addiction programs.
Oregon energy giant PacifiCorp must pay more than $42 million in punitive damage to 10 Oregon survivors of the Labor Day wildfires of 2020. This according to a jury decision on Tuesday. It's the third jury verdict in consumers' favor since last year. That's when the corporation was found to be negligent in failing to protect Oregonians after state fire officials warned wildfires could be touched off by PacifiCorp's operations during an environmental heat emergency. Thousands of other class members are still awaiting trials, but both sides could reach a settlement before then. PacifiCorp is a unit of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Corporation. They're appealing the decision. The utility told the Associated Press Tuesday that it's settled hundreds of claims related to the fires and, quote, remains committed to settling all reasonable claims for actual damages under Oregon law.
Super Tuesday solidifies the likely replacement for Dianne Feinstein's seat in the Senate. House Democrats consider legislation to disqualify insurrectionists from office, and Arizona Senator Sinema says she won't run again. With more on those stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It is so important that you are engaged. It is so important that you're going to go out and vote. We do not have the luxury of disengagement.
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff says Californians need a senator who can fight for democracy and stand up to former President Donald Trump. As the leading Democrat in that state's nonpartisan Senate primary, Schiff seems positioned to replace the late Dianne Feinstein. Some exit polls suggest the economy and immigration are top voter concerns. In North Carolina, Republican Mark Robinson won the nomination for governor. The controversial lieutenant governor endorses occult and satanic conspiracy theories and makes virulent online attacks on gays, immigrants, and Jews. He'll face Democratic State Attorney General Josh Stein in what has been a competitive state. Following the Supreme Court's ruling that Colorado can't remove Trump from the ballot, some House Democrats say they'll revive long-shot legislation to disqualify insurrectionists from office. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin says the high court punted, leaving it up to Congress.
And the House of Representatives already impeached Donald Trump for participating in insurrection by inciting it. So the House has already pronounced upon that, and there was also a 57-43 vote in the Senate.
Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona says she won't seek re-election. The idiosyncratic former progressive angered Democrats by opposing big White House bills. Last year, she spent months negotiating bipartisan border security legislation, which was ultimately rejected by Senate Republicans. Announcing her retirement, Sinema cited the lack of cooperation.
Because I choose civility, understanding, listening, working together to get stuff done, I will leave the Senate at the end of this year.
Her departure clears the way for Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego to face former TV anchor Carrie Lake, who has promoted numerous false election claims. New Mexico Governor Lujan Grisham has signed legislation banning guns near polling stations with broad exemptions. Grisham points to the state's high rate of gun-related injuries.
Fewer guns on the streets makes everyone safer, and I'm focused on everyone's constitutional rights, not just those the NRA says I should be focused on.
And three-quarters of Arizona voters now use no-excuse early mail-in ballots, but House Republicans there say the system no longer works. They've passed a bill that would force in-person voting this November. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A federal court has banned the use of a highly controversial but popular pesticide in the Midwest. Advocates for sustainable agriculture say the ruling is long overdue. The Environmental Protection Agency first approved dicamba in 2017 for spraying on genetically engineered corn and soybean crops. But dicamba is highly prone to drifting, which makes it hard for farmers to control where it winds up. George Naylor is an organic farmer in Sheridan, Iowa. He's farmed corn and soybeans conventionally for 40 years until he noticed the unintended effects dicamba was having on his crops.
I used to use dicamba. I could see when after a rain how it washed off of a cornfield into my soybeans and hurt my soybeans. So I'd say it's a very dangerous chemical and it can be easily moved through groundwater.
The ruling bans future dicamba production, but it does allow farmers to apply the pesticide labeled with dates prior to the court's action. Naylor says beyond the environmental and health concerns of using dicamba, there were also financial considerations that prompted a switch to organic farming.
I could see my soil deteriorating, and I also looked at the price of what herbicide was going to cost me one year, and I go, jeepers, creepers, herbicides weren't working anyway very well, so I just will try organic, which is what I wanted to do from the very first day.
The Center for Food Safety estimates dicamba has affected as many as one in every 6 acres of ultra-sensitive soybeans.
Paging Captain Ahab, a gray whale has been spotted off the coast of Nantucket, the Boston Globe reports. Scientists from New England Aquarium's aerial survey program spotted the whale as they were flying off the coast of the Massachusetts island on Friday. Gray whales have not been seen in the Atlantic Ocean since the 18th century, where researchers believe they were driven to the edge of extinction by commercial whaling. Elsewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, the gray whales are threatened by oil and gas exploration, entanglement with fishing gear, and collisions with ships. The researchers say the whale dove and resurfaced as if it were feeding. Video of the whale was examined back at the aquarium where three experts identified it. Orla O'Brien is an associate research scientist at the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life. O'Brien told the Globe, quote, "It was just kind of this crazy feeling because looking at the photos, it was undeniable that it was a gray whale. But we know that gray whales don't exist in the Atlantic. So it was just this cognitive dissonance almost. It's like, I know what I'm looking at, but I can't believe my eyes," end quote. The scientists suspect that climate change might be the reason the whale resurfaced off the New England coast.
Moving our newscast back onto land, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed plans for recovering grizzly bear populations in central Idaho. The public can comment on their planned alternatives. Eric Tagedoff has more.
Grizzly bears could make a comeback in Idaho's Bitterroots under proposed plans from the federal government. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has opened its potential recovery plans for public comment. Grizzlies are recovering in two other parts of the West, the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem and North Continental Divide Ecosystem. However, Jeff Abrams with Idaho Conservation League says that hasn't happened in the Bitterroots.
Allowing them to move from these recovery zones that have seen these successes into a huge swath of the country that hasn't. And Idahoans in particular are in a place to be helpful in those conversations.
The Bitterroot Recovery Zone, identified by the Fish and Wildlife Service, covers about 6,000 square miles in central Idaho and a sliver of Montana. The public comment period for the plan is open through March 18th. The Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed four alternatives for restoration: active reintroduction of grizzlies, natural recolonization, facilitating connectivity with other recovery zones, or no action. Abrams says his organization favors a combination of natural recolonization and facilitating connectivity. But grizzly protections have been controversial in the region, with some saying enough bears already thrive there. Abrams says part of the recovery efforts will involve conflict management.
Educating communities about bears being nearby, about bears potentially using habitat that folks like to recreate in, and how we can do that responsibly and safely is all part of the discussion.
Abrams says it will take bold action to bring grizzlies back to the region.
We can definitely develop a tenable plan for the Bitterroot with the right mix of vision, of leadership, and courage, which is what it's going to take. And the bears themselves have shown that this can be done.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Charlie Fisher from Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. We'll be talking about Oregon's Senate Bill 1596, which cleared the Oregon legislature this week and now heads to Governor Tina Kotek's desk. It is the most comprehensive right-to-repair legislation in the country. Then at 6 o'clock, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku. And then at 7, the Global Sale. Tonight's weather, a little bit chilly for March. Partly cloudy and 29. Tomorrow, sunshine with light and variable winds. Highs in the upper 40s. Today in history, in 1964, the Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad officially gives boxing champion and civil rights activist Cassius Clay the name Muhammad Ali. The quote of the day is from jazz guitarist Wes Montgomery, who was born this day in 1923. Montgomery said, quote, "Regardless of what you play, the biggest thing is keeping the feeling going."
Super Tuesday is behind us, but advocates say there's more work to be done to increase Native voter turnout before the fall election. And the question of who will do felony law enforcement on the Flathead Reservation of Montana is still up in the air. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tuesday's big primary day in the U.S. had victories across the country for both President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump, leading to a likely rematch in November. While Super Tuesday is over, attempts to boost voter turnout among Native people are underway, including in Wisconsin. Chuck Kornbach of Station WUWM in Milwaukee reports a new mural is part of Get Out the Vote efforts.
The mural now hangs outside the Gerald Ignace Indian Health Center in Milwaukee. The painting features a woman in a jingle dress standing near seven children and reads, "Vote for our seventh generation." At a dedication ceremony, Ho-Chunk artist Christopher Sweet said every election is important.
"In this year, every vote is critical. When I was painting this mural, I thought about my children's futures. But it does not end there. Let's think about all of our future generations."
The celebration of the mural is just the start of Get Out the Vote collaborations this year in Wisconsin, which is a presidential battleground state, and there is divided control of state government. Ann Egan Walkaw of the group Wisconsin Native Vote is a member of the Menominee Nation. She says if there's voter apathy about the race for president, she has not experienced it.
"You know, when I'm out talking to my people, I hear a lot of enthusiasm because they do understand climate change. Do you remember when the Canadian fires were going? We had people literally sick. I got sick down here. But our people see it, and they really know that Mother Earth needs our help. By voting, they can help."
Egan Walkaw says there are plans to work with the Milwaukee Public Schools to register more 18-year-old students to vote. Other Get Out the Vote efforts are planned at tribal communities in northern Wisconsin. There are roughly 70,000 Native Americans of voting age in the state. The last two presidential contests in Wisconsin were decided by only about 20,000 votes. I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Montana Governor Greg Gianforte says the state will not take over law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation. That's in response to Lake County saying it's pulling out of a long-standing agreement to do that work. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton has more.
It's unclear who will take over felony law enforcement oversight following Gianforte's letter saying the state can't afford it. Lake County Commissioner Gail Decker says the letter raises more questions than answers.
"Who has jurisdiction? Does the county have it? Does the state have it? Does the feds have it? Again, that's a question that is on people's minds, and we don't have an answer to it."
In the 1960s, the federal government, the state, Lake County, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes all signed on to a deal called Public Law 280. The deal said Lake County would jail and prosecute people for felony crimes committed on the reservation. But Lake County last year announced it's pulling out because it can't afford the roughly $4 million it costs to oversee felony jurisdiction. Now Gianforte's office says the state also plans to pull out of the agreement. Gianforte says he is initiating a process to give felony jurisdiction to the federal government. It's unclear whether he can do that on his own or needs buy-in from state lawmakers. It's also unclear whether the federal government will agree to take over. The CSKT issued a letter saying it will continue to work with the county and the state to find a path forward. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Donald Trump won all of the Republican Super Tuesday primaries. Nikki Haley won the Vermont primary, but suspended her campaign, still refusing to endorse Trump. President Biden won all of his primaries except for in American Samoa. However, around 20% of Minnesota's voting Democrats chose uncommitted, while 13% in North Carolina chose no preference. These votes are largely in protest of Biden's strong pro-Israel stance. Trump was asked about Gaza on Fox News last night, and he said Israel should, quote, finish the problem. He also claimed the October 7th Hamas attack, quote, would never have happened if I were president. Both Biden and Trump are expected to have enough delegates to secure their party's nominations within the next 2 weeks.
Meanwhile, California Governor Gavin Newsom's proposition to invest billions of dollars in bond funding for housing and residential treatment facilities serving people with severe mental illnesses was narrowly passing as of this morning. If it does pass, Proposition 1 authorizes $6.38 billion in bond funding dedicated to people with severe mental illness. Critics say it would divert a significant amount of the state's mental health budget away from preventative mental health programs for at-risk communities. The proposition is part of a wave of policy and funding that proponents say will get more people off the streets.
More news out of California, where San Francisco voters approved a measure requiring welfare recipients to take a drug test as a condition of receiving services. Proposition F received 63% of the vote last night on Super Tuesday. It affects adults who receive cash assistance from the city of San Francisco to pass a drug screening. If they fail, they join a free treatment program. They are required to actively participate in the drug treatment program, but while there's not requirements that they pass a drug screening, those who fail or refuse to participate in the treatment program will lose their city cash assistance. However, they are still eligible for food stamps and medical benefits from the state of California. That law takes effect January 1st, 2025. The measure was supported by San Francisco Mayor London Breed, who said the measure would give her, quote, the kinds of tools I need to continue the work we're doing, end quote.
Opportunities for good-paying jobs exist in rural areas across Washington and the rest of the country. This despite myths that these places have been hollowed out in recent decades. That's according to a new report found that rural Americans had a 50% chance of working a good-paying job, compared with 54% in urban areas. Martin Vanderwerf is with Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce, which conducted the research. He said there are recent troubling trends for rural areas, including aging and shrinking populations, and a high number of people not in the labor market.
On the other hand, a lot of development could take place in rural areas, and we as a country simply can't afford to just say, we're not going to really regard these rural areas. We all should be doing a lot more for rural areas, just as much as we're doing for urban areas.
The report found racial and gender gaps in employment are higher in rural areas, but it also found outliers. In Washington State, for instance, Native Americans have a higher likelihood for a good-paying job in the north-central part of the state, and Black Washingtonians had a much higher likelihood of finding good paying work in the San Juan Islands. Vanderwerf says it's important to focus on education, such as the ability to attain bachelor's degrees at community colleges, which are more accessible in rural areas. He says employees should connect with schools more, too.
There ought to be just closer ties between the labor force and educators so that we are actually educating young people and middle-aged people and older people for the jobs that actually exist rather than jobs we wish would exist.
Vanderwerf says there are unique advantages to rural areas, such as for manufacturing, which needs a lot of space to operate. That's also true for alternative energy sources.
If you're going to build a solar array or a wind farm, you got to do it in a rural area. You can't do it in an urban area. And when that happens, what kinds of jobs are needed to support it? What kind of infrastructure must be created? And all that sort of thing could really help rural areas and the rural economy.
That was Martin Vanderwerf with the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce.
Researchers at Purdue University are working to detect how cancer cells respond to chemotherapy using ultrasound. They hope the results can be potentially transferred to treating humans with cancer. Terry D. has more.
In the first experiment of its kind, Purdue University researchers treated canines diagnosed with cancer using chemotherapy to see if their response could lead to future treatment for human cancer patients. Chemo resistance, a patient's adverse reaction to chemotherapy, can lessen remission and survival time. Oncologist Dr. Michael Childress at Purdue University's College of Veterinary Medicine says the dogs were chosen because they had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This condition mimics the cancer phenotypes or traits that would be needed when treating human cancer patients.
Every dog's cancer is a little bit different from every other's, and that's what makes dogs an especially valuable research model when you're trying to develop a technology that predicts which individuals' cancers are going to respond to chemotherapy and which are not.
Armed with more information on a patient's reaction to certain medications, researchers can better customize a patient's wellness plan. The Indiana Cancer Consortium reports many cancers can be prevented through lifestyle changes such as diet, eliminating tobacco use, regular physical activity, and avoiding excessive sun. Another method of cancer treatment used to measure chemoresistance is Doppler ultrasound or biodynamic imaging. Professor of Physics and Astronomy David Nolte says light is scattered through pieces of biopsy tissue to match with the light image's reflection pattern to see how patients respond to chemotherapy. He hopes other oncologists see Purdue's findings as useful.
We work with doctors, but the doctors are not making any decisions based on our technique yet. So we have a collaborator down at IU School of Medicine looking at esophageal cancer in human patients. But we are not currently influencing how the doctors make their decisions.
Nolte says a clinical trial is also needed. After that step, the Purdue team would start to inform doctors of the trial's results. The Cancer Consortium reports surgery, chemotherapy, hormone therapy, immunotherapy, and radiation are the top methods used for cancer treatments. This is Terry D. for Indiana News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Israel and Hamas's talks on releasing dozens of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners stalled today. Hopes the negotiations in Cairo would conclude by Ramadan have been cut short. The New York Times reports the talks centered on a proposed six-week halt in fighting, during which Hamas would release 40 hostages in exchange for, quote, a substantial number of Palestinian prisoners. The talks proposed the release of all the female hostages held by Hamas in exchange for an average of 10 Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli prisons for every Hamas hostage. American officials say the negotiations were scuttled by Hamas's demand for a permanent ceasefire. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken confirmed that the U.S. position only went as far as establishing a temporary ceasefire as a condition for allowing more aid trucks into Gaza.
Are you planning a trip to the Big Apple soon? Well, you'll be interested to know that the New York City subways will be getting more crowded as Governor Kathy Hochul has ordered 1,000 National Guard and state police officers to be deployed on the city's underground. That's in addition to the 1,000 city police officers Mayor Adams added last month. These actions are in response to a 45% spike in major crimes in the subway system in January compared with the same time last year. Most of these crimes were grand larcenies, thefts without the use of force. Governor Hochul said, quote, no one heading to their job or to visit family or to go to a doctor's appointment should worry that the person sitting next to them possesses a deadly weapon, end quote. The additional officers are part of a $20 million plan that would also introduce legislation allowing judges to ban people convicted of a violent crime from riding the subways. It would add cameras to train conductors' control booths and also coordinate with prosecutors to track repeat offenders.
It is Wednesday, and that means a visit from KABU News poet Dan Raphael, who finds more sunshine in winter weather than in the news.
I'm glad we've been getting sun breaks between the cold drizzle and gray gloom. These days I'm afraid to look beyond what's out my window. The Supreme says Donnie must stay on the ballot, and they'll let us know by June if he has immunity or the trials related to the 2020 election can begin. Then when Donnie's found guilty, McConnell will shut down the Senate until Donnie is crowned in January. The polls say this year's election's already decided. The Republican strategy of media manipulation and dumbing down education is working. Maybe the only thing that can keep Donnie out of the White House is his buddy Putin going through with his threat to lob a nuke or two at Europe. How's that for deciding the lesser of two evils? What can we do to stop the runaway train of American democracy from jumping the tracks? Stay positive, question the polls and the news, remind others what happened the last time Donnie tried to bamboozle the country into fascism. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 6th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, ideas, what have you, at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Reed Johnson. The producer is Lisa Loving, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Terry D., Suzanne Potter, and Catherine Carley. The director of Evening News is the effervescent Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be speaking with Charlie Fisher from Augsburg about Oregon's newly passed Right to Repair bill.